Hey everyone, I'm Chris Hall and you're listening to the Downtime Podcast. If you're looking for the most in-depth insight into the world of downhill and enduro mountain biking, then this is the podcast for you. For all the links mentioned on this and every episode of the podcast, you can find them at downtimepodcast.com. All you need to do is head to the page for the episode you're interested in. While you're there, we've got a subscribe page that will help you subscribe to the podcast and also to our newsletter. Subscribing is free and it's the only way to make sure you get all of our episodes and you'll get them as soon as they drop. If you're enjoying what we're doing and want to show your support, then you can join a growing group of Downtime supporters by heading to downtimepodcast.com/shop and treating yourself to something nice. It's all top quality, ethically sourced and shipped without the use of any plastics. You can also give us a follow on social media by searching for Downtime Podcast. In this week's episode, I'm going to be talking to Aaron Kirsten, who, along with his wife Emily, founded PNW Components. You may have heard of PNW Components as they've been kind enough to help support the podcast this month and to provide you listeners with a generous discount code. I've been using their Bachelor dropper post with the Loam Lever remote, and I can safely say they're making great stuff. The Loam Lever is easily the best dropper remote I've ever used, and it's all down to the brilliant details, like the little silicone pad for your thumb to push against. If you want to check out what they do, then head to pnwcomponents.com and use the code DOWNTIME at the checkout for 10% off until the end of June. Okay, I'm going to chat to Aaron about his experience as a product manager for Specialized and Marin and find out more about his entrepreneurial side that's enabled him and Emily to go all in and create their own mountain bike brand. For anyone wondering what it takes to do your own thing in the mountain bike world, there's a lot to learn from this episode. Right, it's time to get into it. So without further ado, here's Aaron Kirsten. Aaron Kirsten, welcome to the Downtime Podcast. How's it going?
It's going well, man. Thanks for having me. This is awesome.
That's a pleasure. Let's wind back the clock then, which is kind of where we start most of these episodes these days. And tell us a little bit about like where you grew up, what was going on, and how you got into riding.
Yeah, man. So I grew up in a city called Napa, California. So kind of Northern California area in the States. And grew up, somewhat average lifestyle, right? But grew up doing mountain biking, really got hooked on that and got kind of into dirt jumping. That's really where I gravitated towards. Still doing dirt jump on, mountain bikes. Then I did a little BMX racing and was able to do that for a bit. But really, once downhill became a sport, I think the first one I did was maybe in 1997. Once that happened, I was just absolutely hooked. So that was kind of my obsession for quite a long time. I was working in bike shops as a mechanic and using that to fund my racing, and was racing up in an area called Lake Tahoe in California.
Yeah.
So just really, really loose, rocky, sandy type of soil. A lot of roots and things like that. So that was kind of how I got my start and, made it to the professional level briefly, ended up breaking my back and kind of looking at reconsidering my life there.
How did that happen?
So I was... it's funny. So this was in May of 2005. So we had driven up to Ashland, Oregon, maybe 6 hours north of my hometown, for what was the first slopestyle competition in our area. So it was this event got put together, and we everyone drives up there, and what happened was they didn't pull the proper permits, so the fire department showed up and shut the entire event down. So we didn't get to ride, and I was still feeling pretty excited. So we drove back home and went to this big free ride area near my house. And I ended up just going off of a North Shore style drop and didn't pull up enough and just landed right on my head. And, ended up, I didn't know it was broken until I went to the doctor, but it definitely hurt, pretty bad. But I went into the bike shop the next morning and could barely walk. I was just really stiff. My boss was like, "All right, you need to leave. You need to go to the doctor." So I went in and they did the x-rays, and basically I was off the bike for quite a few months. So that was interesting. And unfortunately I still have quite a few issues from it, and it just never healed quite right. So,
Did you have to have any treatment for it, or how do you treat a broken back?
Yeah. So it was a compression fracture, right? So of my T6 vertebrae. So it's kind of right between your shoulder blades. Where it was, they you can't put a cast because that would then cause massive atrophy of the muscles around the spine and all your supporting muscles. So the other issue is I had some broken ribs too. So they basically just have to deal with it. They don't give you painkillers because they don't want you to ignore the pain. because it can make things worse. So you just, you know, you just kind of deal with it. And then, so yeah, it was, I don't know, about 8 weeks of pretty, you know, not sleeping very well and all that. But I was, I also was stupid. I was 19 years old and I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to, I was like still riding a little bit when I shouldn't have. So I kind of made it worse for myself, but lesson learned on that one, man. You got to definitely do the rehab.
Yeah, that's the thing. So, you got to look after yourself.
Oh yeah, for sure. So anyway, so yeah, I was doing that and really gravitated towards kind of free ride and got into trail riding actually pretty late, like maybe, I don't know, 2011, I guess, right when I started working at Specialized is really where I kind of made the switch into trail riding.
Okay. You raced quite a bit. You raced at quite a high level or like an elite level?
Yeah, I mean, it was elite level, but man, I mean, I'm not sitting here saying I was anywhere close to the top pros. Like I was in the pro class, but not competing very well. I never had the fitness. Like skills were okay, but I wasn't able to pull together with, you know, being able to just do all out sprint out of corners and through the entire course. So that was also a wake up call of like, all right, if I'm going to do this, like I really need to start training and not just riding for fun. And so that's, yeah, that along with getting injured, it all kind of came together of like, all right, I think I'm out here to just have fun and the racing career is probably not for me. So
fair enough.
Yeah, man.
So when you were young, what was in your head as far as jobs? What sort of stuff were you thinking you wanted to do?
You know, coincidentally enough, like from day one, I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur. Both of my parents are entrepreneurs. My grandparents are entrepreneurs. I have, you know, aunts and uncles on both sides of the family who have started businesses. So kind of, you know, growing up in that environment, that's, I don't know. I remember when I was like 12 years old, I had this, what I thought was going to be this really cool invention, you know, at the time with like cross country racing, it was pretty common for a lot of riders to like throw the bike up on their shoulder and run up like a really technical climb. And so I'm thinking, I'm like, oh, wow, it'd be so cool to have like a pad that was attached under the top tube. And then that could rest on your shoulder when you're running, you know, running the bike up the hill, which, you know, now in retrospect was probably a pretty shit idea. But at 12 years old, I was like, oh, man, this would be, a business I can start. So that's really where kind of started. You know, I did like t-shirt companies through high school and college. And yeah, it kind of led from there. So I think that was when I was really young, I wanted to be a Formula One driver. Okay, and then yeah. My family didn't really, well, definitely did not have the money to support that career. So that quickly turned into, yeah, like finding interest in business and inventing and all of that. So that was, kind of in my blood almost.
So what did you study then? What kind of path did you follow through education?
So yeah, I actually got a degree in business entrepreneurship in college. So that's, I did a business plan competition with a friend in college. So I learned a ton doing it that way. Just kind of not just what you read in a book, but actually trying to apply it to, you know, how would you create a business if you were to start it? And how would you attract investors? All of that. And then I interned for an angel investment group that was located near my college. So that really opened my eyes to the world of, you know, startups and entrepreneurship. And, you know, I was still riding a ton at the time too. So it was kind of had these two worlds that I was balancing. So it was cool. You know, like I said, for some reason that really, you know, the art of business and creating products really has captured me for a long time.
Okay. But from college, you found your way initially into working with wind turbines?
Yep. Wind turbines. So that was one of the portfolio companies at the internship I was doing. They had invested in this technology, basically. It wasn't even a company at the time. It was just this unique, basically the generator, you know, the wind turbine spin, and they were able to create power at really, really, really low wind speeds. So someone grabbed hold of it, an entrepreneur grabbed hold of this technology and created a windmill that you could actually place at your home. There's obviously limitations there of, you know, whether the city would allow you to do that or not. But yeah, it was the whole idea was it was called a vertical axis wind turbine. It kind of looks like a big egg beater, and it could spin. You know, have these magnets that actually pushed the rotating shaft upward, and so it was almost floating. Like you could just tap the windmill with your finger, and the whole thing would start spinning. So it was pretty cool. But the issue they ran into was they took on way too much investment too quick, and they gave away too much ownership of the company. And then the board members started to, and investors started to kind of get into arguments with each other. And so the company ended up becoming bankrupt, really for those reasons, not so much the company itself. So that was, God, that was eye-opening. That was very interesting to be part of.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. Good to go through something like early stage without it being your money that was at stake, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah. Especially at 22 years old, you know, I just jump into it. I'm like, oh, this is what business is like. You know, there's a lot of like arguments going on within, you know, the upper management that you're kind of seeing, and all types of crazy business practices happening of just crazy stuff. You know, I wish I wrote a book about it. I've probably forgotten most of what happened, but it was eye-opening for sure. So I learned a lot of what not to do, but also, you know, how to be really resourceful with not much money. So that, I think that was probably the biggest takeaway there. So that was pretty cool.
Okay. And then was it from there you went on to Specialized?
Yeah, basically I left that company when things were starting to fall apart, and just basically moved back in with my parents. This was in early 2011. And then was able to somewhat network, you know, like kind of look around at who was who I knew who might know someone that, you know, Specialized. You know, that was a brand that, you know, these bike shops I worked at, that was always the brand that they sold. So I knew the product line well, and I always bought them and liked them, and they took good care of me if I had a warranty issue and all that. So I really wanted to work there. So anyway, I started kind of networking and was able to get my resume handed off to the right person. And coincidentally, very random coincidence, like the person that my friend knew happened to be the person that was hiring for a job. So it really just like the stars aligned. And we, was able to get an interview, was able to get the job, and that was incredible. And that was a really cool experience working there. It was like within my first month of working there, I was like hopping on a plane, going to Taiwan, seeing all the factories, meeting these vendors, seeing how product development's done. And the biggest thing for me was actually seeing how small of an industry this is. Like, so many brands all share the same factories. It really comes down to like the engineering of the frame, and then the components are all very similar. And that was something I was not super attuned to at the time.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And your role there was as a product developer. What does a product developer do, or at least do it Specialized anyway?
Yeah. I mean, you know, they're constantly evolving, like how the teams are set up and what the different roles are. But at the time I was there, at least, it's pretty wide range. So it's everything from doing the market research ahead of time, right? So you're always developing things at least 2 years ahead. So you're looking upstream of like, okay, people are starting to modify their bikes in these ways. Like, is there a way that we could come up with like a purpose-built solution to cater their needs, right? So there's that type of thing. You then go around globally and study these markets, like start asking questions, see how people are customizing their bikes, how are they using your existing bikes, and if there's any complaints there. And then you kind of gather those thoughts, you go back and you meet with your product marketing team, and start coming up with like, is there a way that we can have a unique edge, right? Like, is there some unique marketing perspective? And then you shuffle that over to the sales side of the organization. You do these presentations with all these market leaders of, hey, here's what I think we should be doing in 2 years. And then you balance that with what's coming, you know, in a year from now. So there's that side of it. And then there's the just true development, right? So you're actually working with engineers to develop products. You are doing the bill of materials. That's really what I lived in. You know, at the time they were using Excel spreadsheets. So I had these things with every single model of bike, with every component, every little option for each component, you know, color and finish and size and bolt style and whether they had Loctite on the bolts or not, you know, all of these things really amplify pretty quickly. So, I mean, the spreadsheet had tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of cells that you're managing. And then you're also working with these vendors to negotiate pricing. So like for every part on a bike, you have anywhere from 3 to 10 different vendors that you're working with at a time to try and get, you know, the best price, the best features and best delivery. So it's a lot, you know, you have a network of, you know, 300 plus suppliers that you're actively working with at any given time. So, so there's, you know, it's kind of all across the board. You know, it really, what I liked about it is it was a mix of, you know, marketing, sales, engineering, and then, you know, operations over in Taiwan, which was very cool. So that, it's stressful, but man, I'm not going to lie, it was really gnarly. It's, you know, there were many nights where I was working till, you know, 2, 3 in the morning just to make sure that I was getting all my specs done, times where, you know, you don't even start getting to your inbox until 5 p.m. So like your like true work day kind of begins at that time because you're in so many planning meetings or whatever it may be. So it's a grind for sure. Yeah, and then on top of that, you know, you're traveling all the time. I was gone 30% of the year, 30, sometimes 40% of the year, just kind of depending. So you're always out there on the road and, I don't know, you get sick a lot just because your immune system gets beat down. You're stressed out. So it's definitely an intense job.
Full on. Yeah. Was it that sort of intensity and nature of it that led you to move on from specialized, or were there other reasons?
It definitely was. It was a grind. I put everything I had into it. And I think because of that, I let myself burn out. Like I should have put up, you know, I was young. I didn't know where my limits were. And so I should have protected myself a little bit. And I've obviously learned how to do that now. But yeah, I got to the point where I was just like, I need to do something else. And so I actually started a little bike tour business back in my hometown. So I was, you know, a customer could reserve a bike and I would go drop it off to them and pick it up. So, you know, tourists didn't have to like rent a bike rack and schlep a bike around. Like I was able to actually drop it off where they wanted it and pick them up wherever they wanted. So that was kind of fun. But that was kind of my decompression of like, well, what do I want to do with my life?
So, and was that your first kind of, or as an adult anyway, your first foray into like the entrepreneurial side of your personality?
It was. And you know, what I quickly realized is that particular, you know, segment wasn't for me because, you know, the Napa Valley is known for wine, right? So it's, everyone's there to go taste wine. And so what would happen is, you know, in this type of model, you know, people are usually on time to pick up the bikes. But then at the end, you know, they get to drink in and they're having a good time. And so like, you know, hey, I'll see you at 4 p.m. then turns into like 6, 7, sometimes 8 p.m. And I'm just sitting there because, you know, they're not picking up their cell phone and just, you know, being overall not so considerate. Yeah. And so that kind of took a toll on me. I was just like, you know what, I'm doing my best to kind of help you out. And I'm now just kind of sitting in a parking lot for 4 hours. So that happened pretty often. And I quickly realized, you know, I need a way to support myself outside of this, because, you know, things take a while to catch on. And I didn't have any other sources of income at the time. So a combination of that, as well as just not a great fit personality-wise, mm-hmm. Led me to then, again, stars kind of freaking randomly aligned. A friend of mine I worked with at Specialized had explained that Marin Bikes had an opening for their, you know, an MTB product manager, and was curious if I was interested. And so that's how I ended up there. So it was kind of perfect timing.
Yeah. Is it Marin where you met your wife?
No. So Emily and I actually met here in Seattle through a college friend. And so she moved down to California when I was at Specialized, and she was working at Mike's Bikes, which is a massive retailer down in California. So she was working there while I was at Specialized. And then, we both made the move back up to Northern California, after I left Specialized. And so we were both, you know, she was working, she was doing some like freelance, photography work and graphic design. And she had actually started going to school for graphic design. So that was kind of a nice reset period for both of us to kind of figure out what we want to be doing, you know, into our more adult years. And, so yeah, she kind of did a reset there. I did as well. And I ended up at Marin, and she ended up at Marin later on, about a year after I started.
Yeah. And how was the job at Marin? Was it a different culture to Specialized? Because it's a similar kind of job role, yeah?
Yeah, so I became the product manager. And at a company that size, it's pretty similar. You do have additional responsibilities of, you know, doing like sales presentations to distributors. You have more of a role in marketing. Like at Specialized, it's more like, hey, I think, you know, from a development standpoint, I think that this is where this bike sits in the market. And here's some, you know, similar products. And here's how these brands are positioning it. But at Marin, it was much more hands-on, working directly with like the head of marketing, and really having more of a say on how these bikes should be, you know, what type of imagery they should be shown, how they should be talked about, what features are interesting that should be definitely mentioned, and what makes them unique. So that was cool. That was really a learning experience for me to take the technical knowledge more, you know, kind of widening my skill set, I guess. So that was cool. So I learned a ton there. And yeah, Marin's, I mean, it's a small company, man. I was very fortunate that the other guy I was working with, Aaron Abrams, he's first off one of the most talented developers I've ever come across. Tons of, you know, he lived in Taiwan for numerous years and really has a great, great understanding there. So got to learn a lot from him. And then I got to work with Mike Faltzgraf, who's in my mind, the most talented artist and graphic designers ever, right? So the guy's incredible. He's very good at branding. So he's doing all of their graphics still. So we kind of had this like little dream team, right? Like we got to travel the world together. We got to develop bikes and had a great time doing it. So that was very cool. So the reason that Emily and I both left was unfortunately her father became ill with brain cancer and I wasn't able to travel anymore. You know, we needed to be here in Seattle taking care of him and basically watching after him. So yeah, we both uprooted, moved up here, and I had to get out of Marin and find a job quickly. So I actually ended up over at Amazon, of all places.
Yeah, that's a big change.
No background in software, but it really was like a desperate attempt. Like I need to do something, and I was able to find a job there and went after it. So, you know, learned a lot about e-commerce there, but that's definitely not like my skill set.
Yeah, what kind of stuff were you doing there? Were you optimizing search type stuff?
Yeah,
I get hazy and really don't understand that word.
I don't want you to fall asleep. It's not super exciting, but so I was doing product management, but there it's very different style of product management, right? Like you're not working with manufacturers, obviously. You know, it's software, so it's a lot of very, very deep dives into data, and you're studying. You know, the one particular thing I was working on was how to help people find clothing faster, because I'm such a fashion icon. So yeah, again, not a great fit, but what it was interesting, right? So I got to learn how customers are searching for things, how things should be organized in search, and then also how items are ranked in these various like search ranking algorithms, right? Like Amazon's search ranking algorithm, how Google's works, you know, at a high level, which kind of, like the light bulbs started to go off of like, whoa, I'm learning a lot about how to properly, you know, set up an e-commerce brand. And I really miss the bike industry. Like, why don't I give some of my former suppliers and manufacturers a call and see if we can get something going? So that's how PNW sparked. Like it was a distraction from the like deeply, deeply depressing stuff that was going on at home. B, it was a distraction from a somewhat kind of mundane job, and C, it really allowed me to get back into the bike industry. So that all of those things kind of came together, and that's where Emily and I were like, you know what, I think we could do something really unique here and actually help riders get on better quality stuff at lower prices. And so that, yeah, again, it was pretty organic how it started. It wasn't like, I'm going to start a company. Let's make a business plan. I was like, I think we can do something cool here and really help people out. So that's where we got it going.
Yeah. And it is you and Emily, you and your wife that run it still. Yeah.
Yeah. So so she's, you know, head of marketing. She does all of our branding. So like the majority of, well, all the product images, anything that's written on the website, most of our, well, all of the graphic design, all of our ads that she's putting out on, you know, the social channels, the packaging, the product graphics. I mean, she's doing it all. It's pretty crazy, that one, you know, anywhere else I worked, that would have been like three or four designers doing it, but she's tackling it all. So yeah, we're still running the day to day. We're fortunate now where we've grown to a point where we've been able to hire some people. So we now have help, as of February, but yeah, since 2015, it was just the two of us, while working full time.
Yeah. So. I was going to say you were still at Amazon. Yeah.
Yeah, so I was doing that. I also had gotten into grad school for, you know, getting a master's in business. And so I was doing those three and bailed on the school. I was like, you know what, if I want to become an entrepreneur, like sitting here and reading books about how to do it is not going to do the job. And also, I don't want to pay a ton of money to go to school for something that I could figure out myself. So I sided towards going all in with PNW, and very quickly things took off and I was able to leave my job at Amazon and do this full time. So yeah, it's been about 2 years now, that I've just been doing this.
Very cool.
It's incredible, man. Yeah, it's one of those things where, like, you know, I read all these books about, you know, if you're going to get, you know, quote unquote side hustle going, like, it's best to stay employed so you can pay the bills and not be super stressed. And, you know, just kind of be patient and scale the business organically. Don't take out a ton of debt. And I just kind of followed those guidelines. And it worked. It's great. Yeah. It's kind of bizarre, but it worked.
Any good book recommendations while we're on that side of things then for people looking to start swimming?
Some books I loved were one that kind of, there's a lot that you should probably ignore because there's kind of a lot of like self, ego stroking in this book. But The 4-Hour Workweek by Tim Ferriss has some really good content in there about starting a business and how to leverage, you know, existing software tools to make your life easier so you're not having to do everything yourself and so you're not having to hire people right off the bat.
Yeah.
That one honestly really kind of kickstarted my journey. Yeah. And then, yeah, I've had some others like Contagious. I think it's called Contagious. It's just a marketing and branding book. That one's great. Art of the Start was one that I read back in the day. That one really helped me out. I don't know. I'm blanking. Cool. There's quite a few. There's about four books at the time I was reading that were really kind of influential. So cool.
Yeah, we'll dig out some links and put that in the show notes so people can find it. So how did you start then? So you've had this idea. You're like, well, I'm learning a lot here. I want to get back into the bike industry. I've got plenty of contacts. What was your first kind of idea or concept or product?
You know, it was Dropper Post. So I was at Specialized. I guess we should rewind. So I'm at Specialized. I see that droppers are becoming more popular. Keep in mind, this is like 2011, 2012. Droppers were not as popular as they are now. And I'm thinking, okay, well, I'd love to bring these downstream onto some more affordable bikes, but the Command Post at the time was a very premium product and there's just no way I could get the numbers to work. So worked together with another engineer, named Ian. At Specialized, Ian McPherson. So basically pitched like, hey, we need to come up with a lower cost product. So we worked with a few vendors over in Taiwan and got the project going. So the nice thing is, you know, I had this personal relationship with our factory starting then. We obviously did lots of business together. I then did business again with them at Marin. So, you know, I'd been working with them, since 2011, developing this kind of stuff. So cool thing there was, Emily and I were living in a hotel that we were able to get for free through, you know, a family friend, cause we didn't really have our act together when we first got to Seattle. And I remember I Skyped, our contact at the factory and I was like, hey, this is Aaron. Do you remember me? He says, yes. I said, well, I'm thinking of starting a company and I'd love to work together developing, you know, Dropper Posts with you. And he's like, you know, we do OEM, like I'm not interested in doing aftermarket. We're not really set up for it. And I was just really, you know, somewhat desperate and persistent. And I just stayed on him for a few months. I was like, dude, come on, we got to do this, man. This is like, I'm telling you, like, I think that we can really do some interesting things. We have a unique like perspective, as a brand and no one's really looking at this type of the market, you know, kind of the mid-level range and doing a really good job there. And I really think we can do something. And so finally he came around, he's like, all right, let's do it. So we got to work. We were able to get some product in hand, you know, within like 3 months after he finally agreed. And then it was off to the races. Like we got him up on Amazon, got our website going, started a little Instagram account. I remember the first sale was like February 12th, 2016. Like we got the company going in 2015. We developed some product, leveraging basically like stuff that it was already existing at the time. That's how we got started. It just started to take off. It really was bizarre. Like, you know, I tried these other businesses and they did not take off. You know, I had probably started 5 businesses before this and seeing it really start to take off and getting emails from customers asking questions. It was an incredible feeling. So that really, I became kind of addicted, right? Like I just was working on this all the time. You know, I'd get up at 5 in the morning before work till 8. At lunch break, I'd answer customer service emails. And then at night, I'd come home, I'd eat dinner, and then just work until like 10, 11 at night. And so it was exhausting. I was always tired, but I loved it. So it really was addicting. So that's, I don't know, that's how things got going. It's kind of interesting to look back on because things are very different now.
And was there any investment at that point, or did you self-fund it?
So I had like $10,000 US in savings, and that's what we used for our first purchase. And I was terrified because I was like, what if we don't sell this stuff? Like, this is a few hundred dropper posts. This is crazy. But Emily was like, nope, you know what? I have faith. We can do this. Let's try it. And so I was like, okay. So we jumped in, and sure enough, we sold through that stuff in a few months, reordered more, you know, use that money to reorder more. You know, we still don't really pay ourselves, like really any profits that come in, we're reinvesting. Obviously we have a team now, so they're getting paid. And we take a little bit here and there if we can, but we really have tried to self-fund this thing and taken on, we were taking on side work, you know, as consultants, you know, as helping people with their Amazon stores. Emily was doing graphic design for a few brands and doing product photography. So we were doing like side work to basically pay the bills so that we could do this full time. So it was, that's how we were able to fund all the purchase orders and stuff. So then, you know, once we got bigger customers like Backcountry and REI and Worldwide Cyclery and Jensen and these guys, I did go out to a bank and get a line of credit. So basically how that works is you're only charged interest when you use the money.
Okay.
And so it's interesting, right? So like when you start these business financials, like a business plan type of thing, you know, you see what type of profits you would be able to get by the end of a term. You know, like let's say you're doing a 12-month forecast and you're like, oh, cool, we're gonna have all this money left over. What I did not realize is, well, things don't stop at month 12. There's then month one of the next year, right? And you need to have money around to pay for this other inventory. So that's where I was like, oh boy, okay, we're growing so fast that every bit of profit we have is going back into larger inventory purchases. So we need, and then you pay the factory, it then sits on the water for a month, it then gets checked in, you then send it to your supply, your retailers, and then they're on net 30 terms. So there's a gap of like 60 to 90 days where you're out of money, and then you can't fund marketing or product development, these other things. So we're able to get some small lines of credit. And leverage those. And now we're able to do things just kind of autopilot just based on our profits coming in. But there's definitely some scary times in there.
Where it was like, the wire.
Yeah, it's like, you know, 1 week, we'd be like 1 week short. And I was like, oh my God, what am I going to do here? And, you know, just was able to make it work somehow. But it was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. So the kind of, I don't know, the mission or whatever of PNW, has that always been to try and bring kind of better value or lower cost, depending on how you look at it, products to the market?
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, for us, I worked at what I would say is one of the more, you know, elite level brands, right? Specializes all about high performance, especially then. Like they're now becoming a little bit more relaxed and about having fun. But the time I was there was all about the Tour de France. It was all about World Cup cross country. It was all about World Cup downhill. And so the, you know, that being in that environment, you pick up, you know, how to do that well. But it's, from my perspective, it's alienating, right? Like not all of us have any interest of ever becoming a World Cup level athlete, but we still want to have fun and we still want high quality product. So I then, you know, my favorite bikes to develop were kind of the lower cost products, because those are the most challenging. You're the most challenged with margin. They're, you know, you just don't have much to work with, but you want to do something cool that someone feels proud of at, you know, $400 or $600, $800, $900. I mean, that's a lot of money for a non-enthusiast rider, right? But Those bikes are typically overlooked. So anyway, I loved that challenge, and taking what I learned from really studying those customers deeply and truly having empathy for wanting more people on their bikes, like that kind of fueled both Emily and my vision of like, I think we can create a really cool brand that has high quality product, because I'm using all the same suppliers I was using, you know, at these OEMs, but bringing them at much lower cost, because we're not so focused on spending a ton to market towards, you know, sponsoring a $20 million Tour de France team or whatever it may be, because all those costs have to be recouped through higher cost product or higher prices on product, right? So our vision was like, well, if we leverage, you know, social media, which is where everyone's at every day, if we can kind of gain some traction there and bring some brand awareness, and then also follow up with incredible customer service that people then start telling their friends about, like, I think that's something interesting, right? So, you know, you're not going to see us sponsoring, you know, again, World Cup race teams are doing, you know, full print ads in magazines or things like this. We try to focus on being resourceful with our ad dollars and getting the message out to where people are telling their friends about us. Like that for me is the biggest honor, and also is very effective from a marketing standpoint. So that's kind of the vision and the way we've been marching forward.
Yeah. Talk us a little bit through then the customer service thing and like how you've approached that, because there's a lot of companies that do it badly.
Yeah. So it was fueled by being pissed off. I'll be totally honest. Like I've been treated so poorly so many times by brands. I was like, oh, come on. Like you can do better than this. You just don't want to. And I also, like my first job out of college at the windmill company, I was the service manager. So I was getting lit up all day long by customers, because the product that we put out was very early and it did have issues. And then, you know, there are all the like issues I was explaining earlier about, you know, intercompany problems, right? So I was kind of the brunt for all of that. So I'm very hypersensitive to ensuring customers are taken care of, because for whatever reason, I take it very personally, and I want to make sure that people are feeling good about their experience with the company. So we spend a lot. Like we're pretty much, you know, we offer a 3-year warranty, which other brands are doing now, but we're very lenient, right? Like if someone's not happy with something, like I'm going to go way, way, way further than any other company that I've come across, at least, to make sure they're taken care of. Like whether that's, you know, getting creative, like let's say someone, like just yesterday, we had someone who bought a product while they're on vacation in Las Vegas, but they live in Israel. Like we're not set up to service anyone in Israel, but he bought too long of a post and now he wants to exchange it. And typically I think most brands would be like, hey, sorry, man, it's not going to happen. Like we don't service Israel, but we're going to do it. Like we're going to pay for the shipping and just deal with it. And sure, like that eats into our margin. But at the end of the day, like he's very likely to tell his friends about his experience with us. And clearly he's a global traveler. So he may tell someone here in the US and they might tell someone else. And that's cool. So that's what we want to do. So, you know, now that we have other folks working, we have TJ is our sales and service manager. You know, he has the empathy that we really demand. Like we don't want someone just sitting there as a placeholder answering emails. Like we want someone who really goes above and beyond to make sure people are taken care of. And we are extremely lucky to have him, because that's exactly what he does. Like if you look through our reviews on our website, more often than not, people mention like, hey, so-and-so was great to work with. Aaron was great. TJ was great. I had a really great experience. Oh, and the product works well. So that for me is almost more important than the product itself. Like we happen to have very high quality product, which, you know, you've been on some of our stuff. It works fantastic.
Yeah.
But what sets us apart is that we are here to take care of you and we're not going to leave you hanging. So I think that's unique. It shouldn't be unique, but it is unique.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you've got a fairly interesting kind of office or, you know, setup in that respect. So you guys, is this right? You still work from home?
Yeah. Yeah. The whole team is remote, man. There's a few reasons. It's again, it's a cost saving strategy, right? Like having a fancy office in Seattle, this is one of the most expensive real estate markets, you know, in the United States. We would have to charge more for our product. So that helps. But that's not the primary reason. The main reason we do it is it allows people, like I've found that forcing people to be at a desk from 8 to 5 just for the sake of them being there is completely backwards and crazy. And that was something that was started here in the States, at least, by Henry Ford. You know, when he had the Ford factory, he wanted his employees there for certain times because that was the most efficient and cost-effective way to manage a factory. So I get it, but that's not what we're doing anymore. Like we're here, typically working on our computers. So there's no reason for us to be forced to sit at a desk. Like if you are, you know, I tend to see that creativity and productivity kind of ebbs and flows. Mm-hmm. And there's times where, you know, maybe you have lunch and you are super tired and you're out of it and you don't want to work. Like that's fine. You shouldn't, because you're not going to get anything done anyway. And you're going to feel resentful that you're there. So you should just kind of interweave your work day into your daily life and make it suit you, right? Like as long as the work's getting done, I don't care where in the world you are. I don't care what you're up to. If you're answering Skype while you're on a bike ride, that's awesome. If you don't want to and you want to say, hey, leave me alone for a few hours, I need to get my mind straight, do it. I don't care. Like that's totally fine. And then that what we've been seeing is people feel more motivated to work. They feel more empowered to make decisions, and they feel refreshed and excited to do things. So that's why we do it primarily, is you have a lot of flexibility. You know, some of our team members have families. If they need to go to daycare and pick up their kid at 4 and they're gone for 2 hours and they, you know, do a few emails at night, that's great. Like, I'm totally down for that. I don't care.
Nice. You're going to get thousands of podcast listeners wanting to work for you now.
All right. That's fine. I'm totally borrowing concepts. I mean, the tech industry, this is very common. It's just the bike industry. I haven't seen it done very often, if at all. So I think we're just trying to do things differently, but still cater to the bike industry.
Yeah. Good stuff. Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about some of the products then. And I'd like to start with something where I think you've taken a different approach, and that's with your handlebar.
Yeah. You know, handlebars are interesting. So that was something in the beginning where I was like, we will never do handlebars because I'm looking around. I'm like, how do you do something unique with a handlebar? Like, it's basically a piece of branding. Like, Spank has a really cool thing. They have VibraCore, right? So they actually inject foam inside the bar, so it gives a good ride feel. Like, that's cool. But there's a patent, so I can't do that, and I don't want to copy them. So like, what else do you do, right? So, but we kept getting requests from customers of, hey, I have your dropper. I really wish that you had other, you know, cockpit components so that I can have like a fully branded kit. You know, they want the stem, they want the handlebar, they want grips, saddles. And I'm like, you know, in the beginning, I was writing back. I was like, hey, thank you so much for this feedback. My concern is I don't know what I can do that's very unique. And so then I'm just selling you a piece of metal and it has a brand on it. And they're like, well, okay, I get it. So we got the request so many times that I was like, okay, we got to do something here. So I went to our factory, the dropper post factory. And they're one of the largest component manufacturers in the world. They make everything, handlebars, they make stems, you know, you name it, e-bike components. So anyway, went to them. I was like, you know, what can we do here? And they said, well, you know what, we're actually working on a new heat treatment process that might be interesting to you. So I, you know, worked together with them on that. And we came up with kind of a nice balance, right? So there's most handlebars that you'll find on the market are made out of 6000 series alloy, and same with frames. So alloy frames are typically 6061. Most handlebars as well are 6061. It's a beautiful compound, right? It's inexpensive. It's pretty forgiving as alloy goes. It has a nice ride quality where it's not ultra, ultra harsh. You know, steel, you know, nothing will compare to steel, but still it has a nicer ride quality to it. You then have 7000 series, which was invented, I believe, originally by Japanese aerospace engineers for a very lightweight and stiff compound, right? So you'll see some components on bikes are now made out of 7000 series. The issue, though, is it's crazy stiff, like really, really, really harsh. And if applied incorrectly, it can actually be pretty brittle, which is obviously a concern. So it all comes down then to the heat treatment process, right? So it all comes down to like what temperature you're putting these products products into the oven for and how long. And what this does is when you heat them to certain temperatures for certain times, these individual compounds that are in this alloy begin to basically meld together and become an even stronger kind of iteration of that same alloy. And it actually is pretty dramatic. So like the standard heat treatment process that you'll see all day long is called T6. And if you know, go ahead and look that up on Wikipedia or whatever, it just has to do with, again, temperature and time. What we started to experiment with is T73. And there are other brands now using it, but what's cool about it is it takes it beyond, like if you're looking at a bell curve on a graph, right, in terms of peak stiffness and hardness of the material, T6 gets it basically to the peak of hardness and strength. But again, very brittle, not very brittle, but very harsh ride quality. T73 takes it a little bit beyond. You leave it in longer in this oven, and it actually brings it back down the backside of this bell curve to where you start to feel more compliance in the bar. So long story short, we have this bar called the Range Handlebar. We're able to deliver it. It's, you know, 300 grams, which is, you know, not much more than a carbon bar. And it's not as harsh as a typical 7000 series bar. So I'm super pumped with how it came out. And we actually have been sold out of it for a bit of time here. Customers are really stoked on that because we're only charging, you know, $69 US, which is very low for a bar of this stature. So what we're doing now is we actually have another version of the range coming out that's higher rise. And what we're focused on now is the ergonomics. So we're getting my personal feedback as well as Emily's was some handlebars, you know, you start to get wrist fatigue when you're out on a long ride, right? Like bikes are becoming even longer with the reach. The bars, you know, everyone wants a wide bar. So you're really stretched out on these bikes. And when you're coming downhill, even to a certain extent when you're seated pedaling, you'll notice your wrists are at a pretty extreme angle. Like the angle that your forearm is coming into your wrist, like you're pretty cocked sideways.
Yeah.
And what happens is your wrists tend to fatigue. So what we've done now is we've created further back sweep, and it's completely relieved our wrist issues. So that's what we're going to be moving forward with on this next version is a 30 millimeter rise bar instead of 20 millimeters. And then the back sweep is more than your standard bar. So that's really exciting. It's just cool that something so simple like that makes a big difference. But, you know, we're pairing that with, you know, each bar purchase, we're giving 5% back to NICA, which is here in the States, we have a national organization for high school race leagues. And so we're going to be giving 5% of all proceeds on that bar back to them, which is pretty cool. So it's, you're getting a few features there. You're getting the ride quality, you're getting the ergonomics as well as, you know, feeling good about your purchase.
Very nice. Yeah.
Yeah, man.
It's a cool way of doing it. You guys have got quite an environmental focus as well, haven't you? I've seen certainly you don't send out like instruction manuals, they're all digital and packaging's kind of all recyclable. Is that right?
Yeah, man, plastic sucks. We're really bummed out on that. And here, being here in Seattle, logging industry is very, it's a huge industry here. So a lot of our riding spots are actually on logging land. And so every once in a while, you'll show up and your trails are gone because all the trees have been cut out. And what we came to find out is our particular spot here locally, Tokel, I believe most of the wood is going towards like toilet paper and printer paper. So, you know, seeing the impact firsthand, you're like, holy shit, this is crazy that we're like wasting trees just so someone can have an owner's manual once and then they throw it away. So we're like, you know what? Why don't we digitize it? We still include a very small, like business card size little insert that says that you can find your manuals online. So we are still using some paper, but you know, the nice thing is that it's way less and also you can recycle it. So what we're moving towards is having no plastic in our packaging for obvious reasons. You know, there's a lot of research coming out of how much plastic is just kind of floating around in our air. And it obviously causes serious issues of, you know, cancer and things like this. And then, you know, a lot of it ends up in the ocean, which is no good. So trying to reduce our impact there. We aren't quite there yet with our droppers. We still use a little plastic sleeve to hold the cables together, but we're working on a new envelope actually that will hold everything together. And then we have no plastic, but our loam lever is pretty damn close. It has, again, that same plastic sleeve around the cable, but everything else is 100% recyclable. So yeah, I don't know. We're not trying to be like overly, I don't know what the word is, but like not trying to push that one too hard because we just want to do it because it's the right thing to do and not try to make it into a marketing thing.
Yeah.
But it just is interesting here. I guess we have a unique perspective because we do see the impact of our consumerism on our local environment here.
Yeah, good on you. It's the right way forward. So it's good that companies are doing it. It's good to see.
For sure. For sure.
Yeah, you mentioned the loam lever and a very simple product on the surface of things, but when you look at it, there's a lot of detail in there and it's clearly been a labor of love. Talk us through that because it's like no dropper lever I've ever used.
Oh, wow. Well, thank you, man. Yeah, it's something we wanted to do for a while. So, you know, we're looking around and we're like, God, there's like for us, touch points on the bike are important, right? Because that's kind of your most direct interaction with the bike. There's a lot of focus on suspension designs, which obviously have a huge impact, but you're not actually touching the suspension. You have your hands on the handlebar and your thumb is on your shifter or, you know, your brake levers or the dropper remote. So we're looking around in the market and there just weren't, you know, the Wolftooth, I think, is the best one that we found. Bike Yoke makes a pretty solid one, but outside of that, like pretty limited options. And a lot of them worked very, very poorly. So, you know, we knew we could do something better. So we got connected with our engineer, Ken. Ken's like total mad scientist, incredible engineer. He's been in the industry forever. And the guy's super dialed. And the cool thing with him too, is he's, located in Taiwan. So he's from here in the States, but he's lived in Taiwan, I think about 10 years, starting when he was working at Trek. So the guy's got a ton of experience and really has made it his kind of goal to, absolutely master the manufacturing side of things with suppliers. So the cool thing with the Lum Lever is we're using predominantly non-bike industry suppliers. Like a lot of these places are ultra high precision, making things for everything from like, you know, motorcycles to, you know, aerospace type things to tech products. So we stepped outside the bike industry to try and really get a different level of machining quality and surface quality than anything else we've seen. So anyway, going back to the objective on that one, obviously it needed to be weatherproof. A lot of levers that use bushings or exposed bearings, like they start to squeak or bind up over time. So that's totally unacceptable. We wanted to eliminate that. A lot of them, you know, I'm not going to use names, but there's some levers there that really take quite a bit of force and it kind of hurts your thumb. Like it's not comfortable to push it. So we wanted a really easy experience there. And then we just wanted some adjustability. Like a lot of these levers, you had no adjustability whatsoever other than, you know, where you put it on the handlebar. So yeah, we went to the drawing board and tested quite a few other products on the market. We made quite a few, you know, rapid prototypes. I actually have one here in my hand that I'm playing with. That was our original rendition. We learned quite a bit from that one. We got them in the hands of riders all over the world. So we were, you know, validating in different markets than just here. And yeah, I don't know. Again, it all kind of came together and I'm really happy with it. I think that it has kind of pushed the bar and it also helps show P&W as more than just droppers and more, you know, focused on like very in-depth engineering and execution of product, right? Like it the surface quality, and you know, we use glass beads instead of sandblast so that it has a more subtle sheen to it, but you can still see the CNC marks because I think they look really cool. Yeah, I mean, you know, the thing's expensive. We definitely went short on margin on that just to compete in the market. We get a lot of comments from people of like, this is overpriced. But for what it is, it's not overpriced. It's really a hands-on project. And I don't know of any other products out there that are at this level of craftsmanship.
No, it's pretty unusual in the bike industry. It's like, I don't know, it's got a kind of Pools components feel, like the old 90s Pools components, like precision machined.
Well, Paul's awesome. And, you know, they came out with a dropper lever and, you know, it's over $100 US. So, I mean, that goes to show what this would typically cost. Because I would assume that their cost is pretty similar to ours at the manufacturing side. So, yeah, no, Paul's an incredible example of that over the years of being able to do really high quality stuff.
Yeah. And even the bolts are custom to you guys. Is that right?
Yeah, bolts are custom. Yeah, we had to do stainless. The one thing that's not unique to us is the barrel adjuster. We started to make one custom that was going to be CNC'd, but then the price just got out of control. So we just buy this one from Jaguar. It's similar to others, but that's a pretty non-impactful part of the lever. It's not going to make or break your experience with it. So anyway, you know, the bolts on the product itself are all stainless and
That's a big commitment. You can't just buy 10 bolts from someone when they're custom.
No, you have to buy 10,000.
You've got to cut a few levers then.
Yeah. So you got to do, depending on what type of bolt, like you either buy 10,000 or 20,000 is their minimum order quantity. So it's, you know, each one's, you know, they're low cost, but still that adds up front and is like, Ken has a ton of these things sitting in inventory as we are manufacturing here. It's pretty funny.
Cool. So you've got a few other products in there. Obviously, the dropper post, like super comprehensive range of those bits and bobs. You've got your stems, which have got like it's like a removable GoPro or light mount. Is that right? That kind of clips into the front plate.
Exactly. Yeah. So the range stem has the GoPro mount. So what we found actually is most people prefer to use a light on there. So you have a headlight, any headlight that has, you know, GoPro mount capability works fine. So that's cool. And that actually got us thinking. We're actually developing some more products that are going even deeper into the light realm with the stem mount. So that got us thinking, like, for e-bikes, there's a ton of interest of having headlights, commuter bikes and gravel bikes. So that's going to be some stuff we'll have coming out here later this year. So that I'm super excited about.
So what exactly is that kind of stuff? Like, can you tell us more? Or?
Yeah, for sure. So we have a new stem. It's basically just a new version of the range. So it's like even lighter. It's got more machining to it. So it's more carved out. But on the faceplate, we've eliminated plastic, like the current version that we're currently, unfortunately, sold out of. It has a plastic mount. So we've now gone with a full alloy version with a stainless like through bolt in the center.
Okay.
It's no longer compatible with GoPro, but it is compatible with most lights out there. And actually what we're going to be doing is we're still in negotiations to figure this out, but what I'm hoping to have is a light and stem like bundle package where you're getting a very high quality light that actually mounts perfect to our stem. And you can buy them together as a bundle with, you know, you'll obviously save cost by doing it that way.
Yeah.
So super stoked on that. And again, that allows us to hit a few different markets because we've got, you know, enduro riders that are doing this, that are wanting lights. You have e-bikes. There's like I was saying, ton of interest there, gravel, commute, all of those. So we should have multiple options for folks.
Wicked. And what else have you got on the go? Have you got some other product development projects going on?
Yeah, for sure. We have a new grip coming out. We're getting samples here in May, so we should have those in stock, assuming, you know, the samples are good. We should have those in July. So the cool thing about the grip is, again, we focused on ergonomics. So it has a tapered shape to it for, you know, proper hand placement. It has various textures on it based on where your hand sits. So initial feedback has been fantastic. I'm really excited about that. And it'll obviously, you know, it'll be all matchy-matchy with the limb lever. It'll be the same colors as the different limb lever thumb pads that, you know, the silicone injection. So we have that coming out. We have more dropper posts. We have one that I'm really excited about for gravel, especially is it's a dropper post and has 40 millimeters of, you know, air charged suspension travel. So it's kind of like combining the best of both worlds.
Okay.
So I'm stoked about that. That'll be here in June. And then what else? We're working on some on-bike storage things. We were working on a pedal, but I ended up scrapping it because it just was not unique enough. Okay. It looked cool, but so do a lot of pedals.
Yeah.
So I wanted to make sure that we actually have a unique perspective here. So I actually just killed that off last week and going back to the drawing board on that. I don't know. You know, we just launched quite a few products in winter, like November timeframe. So we have a pretty refreshed lineup right now, but we do have these additional bits coming soon.
Amazing. Busy time then.
It is. Yeah. And with the Loam Lever, we have more colors coming out. We're going to start doing limited edition colors where, you know, we've got like an all black version. We have a black with pink. And then we have some new just standard, you know, gray body, but with like a red pad and a black pad. So we'll have that available here soon. And the exciting one is a new dropper remote for drop bars. So, you know, typically road or gravel bikes. And a gravel handlebar too. So yeah, we have a lot going on.
yeah, busy times for sure.
Yeah, man.
So you, obviously you've been in the industry a long time and you're focused on what's going on. What are your thoughts on like the next, I don't know, 5 or so years of mountain bike technology or maybe even a bit further out? What kind of stuff do you see coming?
You know, it's been interesting. It's, I'm not trying to downplay any of the hard work that's going into the bikes because I know firsthand how extremely challenging it is, but if you're looking at, I don't know, using suspension technology, for example, like things are somewhat stagnant. There's iterations. Suspension continues to get better, but like we haven't had like a groundbreaking, like if you remember when like FSR VPP first came out, it was like, whoa, this is incredible. This is so different from my single pivot. Like I haven't seen that necessarily. Like Yeti's switch technology is awesome. You know, I ride that bike. It works extremely well. Marin's, you know, nailed suspension is really unique. It has incredible ride quality. So I get that. I think the big thing now is going to be, you know, e-bikes are really taken off. I think that making those lighter and more affordable and more, you know, I think YT's on the right path of making them more kind of decoy, right? So I think that making those less overtly an e-bike is going to be a good thing for those. There's still a lot of challenges I'm not going to get into. I'm not saying I'm like ultra pro e-bike or anything, but I think that regardless of what some riders think about them, like, it's happening. So I think that it's going to be more a challenge on the manufacturer's side of, you know, again, making them more accessible. So that's going to be interesting to watch. Gravel, I just saw Niner has their full suspension version. I know that I've heard kind of through the rumor mill, there's some other brands that are doing full suspension gravel bikes. That I think is really fascinating to watch, because that's one of the only growth segments in bicycles right now is gravel and e-bikes.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to see what goes on there. And I think outside of that, I think on-bike storage is a continual challenge. And a want from customers, you know, having stuff in your backpack or in your pocket sucks. Like, it's kind of a pain in the ass to have. So I think having more stuff on the bike in a nice, sleek, convenient way, is going to become more and more popular. And I know that some of their brands are working on stuff now, as well. And, you know, kudos to 1UP. They have the really cool EDC tool. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah.
I think that more and more of us are going to continue, kind of going down that path.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, man, for sure. No, it's a good time to, it's an exciting time to be in the bike world, because it seems the economy is somewhat strong and still fueling sales. So there's a lot of research going on.
Yeah.
And a few brands are willing to take risks. When the economy turns, you're going to see less innovation, but, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. Fingers crossed. So
yeah.
If people have been listening and thinking, oh yeah, I'm kind of feeling a bit inspired, I'd like to start my own thing, whether that's in the bike world or something totally different, what would be your best piece of advice for anyone wanting to start their own business?
Do it. Like, just go. Get started. Like, the more you sit there and worry about, you know, I don't call it this, but analysis paralysis is a real thing, where you just get so caught up on planning the fine details. Obviously, there has to be some of that goes on, but like, you need to just get started, and you cannot be afraid to pick up a phone and call someone. I think that's been one of the more successful things I've been able to do, is if I don't get a response on email or on a DM, like, I'm going to figure out how to call them. And in regards to like a buyer, right? Like, I'm not calling random people, but if I'm trying to, you know, spark up a sales relationship, like, just call and have a conversation. I mean, we are all people. We are all trying to do a good job. And if you can figure out a way to help someone do a better job, they're going to be more likely to listen to what you have to say, right? So like, if you have something unique that you can help them with, if you have a unique product that will help them sell more things, makes them look great, you know, try to focus on those things and don't make this about you, right? Like, you cannot walk into something like a new business or a new relationship with a sales organization and make it all about you. You need to figure out ways that help the other party become better at what they do, right? And so that's how the relationship should be looked at, in my eyes, at least.
Yeah, good advice.
So, yeah, and again, the biggest, you know, I've really pushed a lot of my buddies up here to start their businesses, and I'm so proud to see that that they're a few of them have gone for it. And it's, I don't know, for me, that's the biggest validation. You know, I just got word that I won a Entrepreneur of the Year award through an investment group tied in with my college. So very excited to go up there in May and accept that. But I think I'm going to give that same advice of, like, if you have an idea, just go after it, see what happens. Like, the sooner you can figure out whether this is going to work or not, you'll figure out whether you're wasting your time very quickly, right? Instead of sitting on an idea for years, like, just do it. Test see how it goes.
Yeah. Good stuff. All right, we're gonna start wrapping up, and we've got our three questions that we ask everyone. So we'll go through those. First one: if our listeners had, I think it's about $200, so £150 to spend to improve their performance on a bike, what would you recommend they spend it on? And let's say it can't be a PNW components product.
I don't want to. That would be no fun. So $200. Let's see. I think that I would go out and buy. I would likely do something to upgrade my fork, like whether that's an upgraded damper. No. Let me back up. I would get a nice set of tires. I think that that's the biggest thing right now is, choosing, you know, the correct correct tread pattern, correct compound of the rubber. I think that is the biggest difference out there on the trail, and God, it makes a world of difference. Like coming off of a shit tire to something that's, you know, made for the type of trails you're doing, like it makes a massive impact and it's not very expensive. And God, you can do that for way less than 200, which is kind of cool. So there's that. And then brakes, I think $200 for a nice set of like four piston XTs or something like that makes a world of difference as well. I don't know. Cool. That's where I focus.
Have you got a favorite tire for kind of, for the conditions that you tend to ride in a lot?
Yeah, so I've been riding the Maxxis, I don't know how you pronounce it, the Asagi?
No idea.
I hear people call it the Ass Guy, but I don't think that's how you say it. So I've been riding that, and that thing is I was terrified of it at first because it's super heavy, because I have the, I forget what their compound's called, but it's like the DH casing.
Yeah.
But holy cow, it really tracks up extremely well. I have no complaints with it now. And then I ride a Maxxis... I think it's like the DHR for the rear. Okay. And those link out well. It's got nice, because it's so muddy here, like you need pretty wide spread between your knobs, and it just totally sheds mud. It works really well.
Sweet. Awesome.
Yeah, man.
All right. Second question. If you could wind back the clock and have a sit down with yourself age 16, what advice would you give him?
Man, I try not to think that way, right? Like I try to... just take things as it come and move on. But I probably would have focused more on school rather than socializing and bikes. I definitely high school I was a pretty bad student. I just wasn't interested in it and didn't put the time in. And you know, my parents were really pushing me hard to, you know, go to tutors, and I just was so hard headed and I just wasn't going to do it. But I would have. I think that's one thing is. I've had to work extremely hard to kind of make up for that through college and even every day. Like I just don't have a solid foundation in certain things. And so I've had to work really hard, and that seems like a waste of time. So I think that's what I would have done is a little more homework, a little less time on the phone or at the dirt jumps.
It's a balance, isn't it? Your social network and your bike stuff has kind of paid off as well. So
I guess you're right. I mean, that's the tough thing. It's like, it's hard.
Yeah, fair play. And then the last one, if you could have a coaching session with anyone past or present, who would it be and what would you want to learn from them? And it can be like we can have a riding one and a non-riding one if you want.
Yeah, you know, I've become a huge fan of Lewis Hamilton as a Formula One driver. I think the guy obviously super skilled, but he on a personal level is pretty rad guy. Like he's very into, you know, reducing plastic. He's into eating well. Obviously very athletic, and just there's to have the mindset to be doing as much as he's doing. You know, he's got all these endorsements that he's doing and clothing line, you know, he's becoming more entrepreneurial while also being like the reigning world champion. I would love to see how he's prioritizing what he spends time on and what he doesn't spend time on. That's always becoming more and more of a factor, you know, as this company grows, as I can get pulled in a million directions, but
yeah.
Staying focused on the most important stuff. I feel like someone like that could have a lot of advice. So I think, I know that one's not in the business world, but I think he would have a lot of cool advice.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's a good one. And what about the riding side? Is there someone who you really look up to in the riding world?
Oh man, I grew up. So I like posters on my wall. My favorite riders were Sean Palmer, Eric Carter, and Kurt Voorhees. Those were like, and this guy, Pistol Pete Lunkarevich.
Yeah,
he was the man. So those were my heroes growing up. I would love, it was bizarre, man. So working at Marin, Eric Carter was actually became one of our sales reps. So that was just like a surreal moment of like, holy shit. Like I literally had a poster of you at Sea Otter when I was a little kid. And now I'm able to work with you. Like this is very cool. So yeah, I would love, I mean, Sean Palmer's a freaking legend, man. That guy's a freak of nature. Just that he's able to jump on any sort of, you know, jump into any sport and just become a master of it immediately. Like, I wish I could have experienced more of that when I was younger and just seeing him, you know, there's something unique about it, the way he thinks that would be really interesting to understand more. But yeah, more modern day. I mean, my favorite riders now, you know, Cam Zink, we grew up racing together. I mean, I'm not going to say we're like ultra, ultra close, but it was really cool seeing him grow his career. Cam McCall, same thing. Tyler McCall, like we grew up doing the same races as kids. So it's been awesome seeing their careers take off. And yeah, on the race side, I mean, Cody Kelly, we just had here for a few days. That guy is insanely talented. If you guys haven't seen him, Kelly MTV is his Instagram handle. The guy's got ridiculous skills. I've never seen really anything like it in person. So that's been a joy to see his career take off as well. And yeah, you know, the classics, right? Aaron Gwynn's very impressive rider. Jared Graves is a freak. Richie Rude. I mean, all those guys are really inspirational to watch. So yeah. I'm pretty stoked, man. It's a cool time for the race world.
Yeah, it sure is. Nice one. All right. Well, if people are kind of interested to see what you're up to and have a look at the products and see some of the new stuff coming through over the year, where's the best place for them to head?
Yeah, I mean, give us a follow on Instagram. We're very active there. Emily manages the account, you know, all day long, every single day. So there's that's where we're trying to release our most, you know, like videos and photos and product releases. And then obviously, our, you know, if you subscribe to our blog, we do send out, you know, unique discount codes just for our subscribers on our mailing list. We do not spam you. Like, we send something maybe once a month at the most. So this is not something we're trying to trick you into forcing you to see all of our stuff. But if you do subscribe to our mailing list, you'll know, you'll be the first to know when we're releasing new product, and then you'll obviously get a discount as well. So yeah, I would give us a follow on the old gram and the website.
Cool. We'll put links in the show notes as well so people can find that stuff. And cool. You're offering a discount code for Downtime listeners, I think, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so if you guys just use Downtime, it's not case sensitive, but yeah, Downtime is the discount code. That'll go ahead and get you 10% off. And that's valid for, yeah, North America, including, you know, US and Canada, as well as the UK and EU all combined there. So yeah, we'll have some nice options for you guys. Now, if you are in another location, just hit us up. Like, we can usually be pretty flexible or refer you to a local vendor. We are in Japan and Australia, New Zealand, Chile, Costa Rica. We're all over the place. So anyway, yeah, just hit us up at info@pnwcomponents.com and we'll take care of you.
Nice one. Good stuff. All right. Well, yeah, thanks so much for your time. It's been super interesting chatting, and yeah, look forward to seeing some new products coming throughout the year.
For sure. No, Chris, thank you so much, man. This has been a pleasure, and yeah, it was fun chatting.
Nice one. Cheers, man. Right. That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed hearing Aaron's story. Head to pnwcomponents.com and check out what they're up to. There's some great products there at really sensible prices. As a Downtime listener, you also get 10% off until the end of June by using the code DOWNTIME at the checkout. Don't forget to follow us on social media, subscribe to the podcast so you get all of our episodes delivered straight to your device, and if you want to get yourself some exclusive Downtime podcast goodies, then head to downtimepodcast.com/shop. Please keep telling your friends about the podcast and spreading the word. We only exist because of everyone who shared what we're doing with their riding friends and supported us along the way. So a massive thank you to all of you who have helped out so far. Right, we've got another awesome episode coming up soon, but until then, get out and ride.